Head on Fire is a Patreon-supported podcast. Supporters of the show get early access to audio and video content, episode archives, monthly roundtables, a book club, and more. All benefits are offered on a sliding scale, so no matter your level of donation, you never miss out. If you like this show, consider supporting it with a dollar a month or whatever you can at patreon.com/headonfirepod. Thanks, and enjoy the show. Pre-K pause. If you've been online in any capacity in the last year, that phrase probably conjures up the face of my guest today, Tell Williams. He was a pre-K teacher for 9 years before resigning to pursue a master's in social work. Along the way, he accidentally found viral fame when a video he posted about the realities of being a teacher hit the algorithm jackpot. He's gone on to try his hand at stand-up comedy, being the face of a nail polish brand, and even act in the new show The Book of Queer that just premiered on Discovery Plus. Despite sitting atop the influencer game, we had a lengthy conversation about his offline life, what it means to be a visibly queer, visibly BIPOC teacher right now when every news cycle seems to both praise teachers and vilify them, what it means for content to be age-appropriate, and just how much our kids actually understand at a young age. I do want to warn you, we do touch on the subject of school shootings, though we do not go into specific details about any one shooting. However, if that topic is sensitive for you at this time, please listen with care. It is a broad conversation about the ups and downs of accidental viral fame and the harsh realities of public education in 2022. It was a great discussion, and I hope you'll enjoy. Without further ado, here's Tell Williams. Tell Williams, welcome to Head on Fire. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Oh my gosh, it is such an honor to get to speak with you. For the three people out there who are listening to this show that have never heard of you, for whatever reason, I cannot fathom, though they've probably seen your videos, tell folks a little bit about yourself and what you do.
Yeah, so I was a teacher for 9 years. I just recently resigned and I'm finishing my graduate degree in social work. So doing that, and then unexpectedly, maybe like a year and a half ago, blew up on TikTok and Instagram. So trying to figure out how to do that as well.
So obviously you purposefully sought out this this viral TikTok fame and fortune for your own nefarious purposes.
Right. No, absolutely not. I have a group chat with my siblings, and I moved away from home with my husband, and we have this group chat, and we, trade gifts and memes, and TikTok started being a huge thing that we were doing. And my brother-in-law was like, you should make a TikTok about something funny that's happened in the classroom, because you're telling us these stories all the time. Other people would find them funny. I'm like, I'm sure they would if someone else told it, but I don't read as funny on camera, so no. And it took them some convincing. I said, I'll make one. And I literally just had an account to watch the TikToks. Like, sure. It had user, then a bunch of numbers, and there was no photo. And I said, I'll make one. If it does well, maybe I'll make an, I don't know. So I made a video, I went to bed, and I woke up the next day and it had completely gone viral. And I had like, I remember it's 50 or 100,000 followers. I'm like, oh shit, so like this, and it just kept going throughout the day. And I was like, well, it's probably a fluke. They probably, everyone's first video probably does really well, so they continue.
Sure.
Post, I have no idea. I don't know. I was 30, I think, with the first one I made. I felt like I was looking at a bunch of 20-year-olds doing dances. And I'm like, I don't know how to do that. So I did a second video and it just kept going. So now here I am.
Now here you are doing Discovery TV shows and being interviewed all over the place. And I think people went as you for Halloween.
Which I don't, I did a comedy tour in spring, which was super fun, and seeing people's reactions to meeting you, I just thought people recognize me from where I'm at in Pennsylvania, because again, I don't know how the algorithm works. Maybe everyone that's TikTok gets my TikToks because they're, close to me. So going on the tour, I was like, oh, this is odd. But then a couple weeks ago, a teacher for school, the school got to pick LGBTQ plus person or advocate and decorate their classroom door for the school's Pride Fest. And I always forget to check my tags because, again, I have no idea how to use TikTok. Instagram, I'm a little bit, I think I have that down, but TikTok. And I was like, oh, I haven't checked my tags in like 2 weeks. And this teacher had made her door of me. And I was like, oh my gosh, like that made me feel like I arrived, you know? Like I don't care if I did TV or people dressed up like me for Halloween. That made me feel like I was like, oh my God, that's so sweet. I want to go to your school.
I make it a habit not to Google myself, but I did Google
Yeah.
you.
Yeah.
And the first result is Tell Williams really a pre-K teacher? So
Of
is
course.
Tell Real Williams really a pre-K teacher?
Tell Williams was really a pre-K teacher for 9 years. Yeah. I don't know. I it's odd too that that's the first result, their first thing that pops up.
Well, I think because I feel like I share a little bit of kinship with you because we are both visibly queer people that
Yeah.
occupied traditionally conservative spaces
Yeah.
dealing with children. So my educational background is in criminal justice, specifically juvenile justice, and I
Yeah.
worked in the juvenile court justice system for a few years. Change of career, obviously, down the road, like you
Like
did.
just a little bit.
Yeah, just a smidge. But I share a kinship with you there. And I'm curious if you felt as I did a need to limit or diminish yourself, to put yourself into this more conservative space, because I feel like conservative space, school, court systems, I mean, there's
Yeah.
just places that feel conservative, banking industry, certain things that just feel very conservative. And also, anytime you're dealing with children,
Yeah.
especially like younger the child, the more you're like, how gay can I be?
Right. And the weird thing was too, it's so I grew up in Northern Indiana when Mike Pence was the governor. Okay. And if people know anything about politics too, Jackie Walorski is our state rep. Like we cannot, Amy Coney whatever, Barrett was a professor in Notre Dame, and I think has a house there. Like, I mean, when I'm saying it's conservative where I live, it is the buckle of the Bible Belt, which most people wouldn't know that about Indiana. And I worked at in the public schools there for the Head Start program and didn't feel like I could be, and I was openly gay, right? Like I was. And there in the public schools in Indiana, working for Head Start, I had the autonomy, right? It was required that the Head Start program had books on LGBTQ plus people and the BIPOC community and any culture and any religion, and it had to be in our classroom. It was part of how we got grants, right? Everyone had to feel represented. And that is where I felt like I didn't have the autonomy to be as open about myself. I would always say spouse or partner, when my husband and I did get married. And then when I felt comfortable, the person would say, oh, my husband. I would never say their own parents either. Like I didn't know. And those parents were, for the most part, say 99% of the time, were super affirming. I had one or two parents, that kind of, were dicks, but then eventually most of them came around. But it wasn't until I got to here in Pennsylvania, and I was working for a private school that didn't necessarily give me that autonomy, right? I was the only, for a while, the only queer person that worked there, and at least very openly queer person that worked there. I was one of two men, and the other one left, so I was the only male. And then I'm Puerto Rican. I'm very white passing, and I acknowledge that. And there's one other person of color that worked there, and they left, so I was the only. For most of my teaching there, I was the only queer, the only male, and the only person of color working there. And there, you would think I felt like I had the autonomy. It's a private school, we have a curriculum we follow, but we can do it. We don't have a standard that the state. And it was there I had most of the issue, and it was there too that I was like, yeah, no, screw it. What are they gonna do? Fire me? And they knew they couldn't, which was I just found out recently. They were terrified that they couldn't fire me because they're like, oh my God, he's has all these little intersections that would just screw us if we ever fired him. So I was like, hey, I can, put up a Pride bulletin board, and I can put up a, you know, Hispanic and Latinx History Month bulletin board and a Black History bulletin board and bring these books to the classrooms that were never there before. And it was weird. I felt like I had more autonomy at a private school in a more, you know, than in Indiana, when they didn't give me that. The private school didn't necessarily was welcoming to that. Indiana was. It was very odd, kind of flip-flopped.
I remember, I don't remember why we only had one car at the time, but my husband, who at the time was my partner, back before we could get married, he was dropping me off to work, and it was, I was still working in juvenile detention at the time. And he dropped me off, and I mean, just, you know, bye, see you later. And then, you know,
yeah,
I get out of the car and go to work. I remember being called into the office. My supervisor said, we need to discuss the fact that, like, you and some guy were, like, making out in the parking lot.
You're like, no, that was not what that was.
In front of, I'm just like, is this really a conversation we're having? So I'm curious, do you feel like over your tenure, 10-year tenure nearly, did it improve? Did it get better?
No, it got worse. I mean, I think we're seeing that. I am told it's like a pendulum, right? And and justice swings back and forth, and that, unfortunately, and I feel like, specifically in the last year, it's just swung back so far. I've over the last 9 years, I feel like we were in such a good place. Mm-hmm. We had, you know, the Trump presidency, and then it just completely towered back, and it gave these alt-right conspiracy theorists, I don't want to even say conservatives, because I know conservatives who are not like this at all, so I'm hesitant to say that, and I say it all the time on my TikTok and use it interchangeably, I need to stop, but it gives them this confidence and autonomy that they get to launch these fabricated and completely outlandish ideas of who and what queer people are, and it's their truth, and it's just, I've never, it's like, it's the second lavender scare, right? It's, we're in a rainbow scare now, and it is it's wild to see.
I think that part of that scare is that adults seem to forget. I don't know how this happens, because I distinctly remember being young. I'm not anymore, but I distinctly remember being young.
Right.
And I distinctly remember, like, how aware of the world I was, how much information I had access to, even out in rural East Texas, even pre-internet. You know, I just remember, you know, I watched the news, and I knew what was going on. I was an informed person. And I was also 14, 15 years old, but I had a mind. I had opinions. They weren't always the most informed opinions, but I had them. And I feel like both media and accepted culture have sort of screwed up our sense of what a 15-year-old is. I mean, you know, when you look on the CW, they're fighting vampires and sleeping with everyone, and they're also played by a 30-year-old. But, like, when you look at a real 15-year-old, they look like a baby. Do you resonate with the idea that, like, even at the pre-K age, they are so much more aware and open and interested and knowledgeable than we give them credit for?
Yeah, I think I don't think that we realize how resilient children are and how capable they are of showing compassion and empathy, but also understanding, right? They're still children, right? They're still, like, I think most of this comes from this idea that teachers were talking to young children about sex, because people do not know the difference between sex and sexuality. And so when we're talking about, if a pre-K teacher is sitting in front of their classroom talking about sex, as a parent, I would be scared too, and probably respond in the way that a lot of these conspiracy theorists have, right? Like, that would be outlandishly inappropriate to try to explain sex to a 3 to 5 year old, you know? That's not okay. And I think that people hear the word sexuality and not realize you can be a cishet white man and you still have sexuality. Everyone does. And I think that they fear that it's intercourse we're talking about. And we're talking about gender. We're talking about, it's okay if Heather has two dads because families look different, and that's fine. And that's where we ended there, right? Because, like, they're 3 to 5. There's a lot of things they don't get. But they do understand that families look different. They do understand that we are people and empathetic, and we should, you know, lead with kindness. And I think that they instill this fear that if a child knows that the teacher has a husband and is a male, or if they find out that, again, Joanne has two moms, people be like, that's going to terrify my child. I watched Snow White, I don't know how many times as a kid, I'm fine. I was not scared to see a dead girl get kissed, and that should have been terrifying. They can find out that, you know, their teacher has a husband.
and then you didn't run off and get married to the first man that kissed you.
I didn't. No, it was the second one that I did, you know, yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about being an educator. Do you feel like, generally speaking, like pull the camera all the way back, do you feel like just educators, education in general right now, and I realize that this feels like a leading question, but do you feel like it's under attack right now?
100%, yeah. And not just, I mean, obviously the queer community and LGBTQ+ stuff is under attack within education, mm-hmm. but it's so much more than that, right? It's you know, learning about BIPOC and race and our factual and not fabricated human and US history, you know? Mm-hmm. I wish I could say it's just you know, social justice, but I don't wish to say that, but it's much deeper than that. I mean, Indiana was trying to pass a law that teachers had to submit lesson plans a year ahead of time, mm-hmm. could not deviate, so parents could check it. And if a parent, if a teacher talked to any student about anything that wasn't academic, if it had anything to do with social and emotional, they could be fired or lose their license. And if a librarian gave a book that was deemed inappropriate to a child, and we're talking about like books that we've all read growing up in our libraries, they could be jailed for that. Like, this was all an Indiana bill that thank God didn't pass. And that was just one state. You know, this is happening all across the US. I don't understand how they expect to have teachers, one, want to go into this position. I don't know why we're shocked teachers are leaving. This shouldn't be a shock to any of us. But to call us a professional of the classroom, but not give us the autonomy and space to teach in a way that we were trained to do it, and in a way that we know is age appropriate. It's wild to me.
What does it mean to be age appropriate? I feel like that term gets used a lot,
yeah,
for all sorts of issues. Sure, right. Things, you know, big sticky cultural topics like sex education and, right. you know, that kind of thing. But I don't hear people talking about age-appropriate discussions of trigonometry. Because I feel like if they did, they might realize that the age-appropriate discussion of trigonometry is like addition and subtraction.
Right. And I think, so when we say age-appropriate, at least when I say, I look at mm-hmm. not the child's, somewhat the child's age, right? Because mm-hmm. although it's arbitrary, we do know that, you know, at this milestone, and what have you, for a fourth grader to learn what calculus is, not age appropriate, right? It's not developmentally appropriate for a fourth grader. So it's just, if the child, in my opinion, is able to experience an issue, that is when it becomes age appropriate, right? When you sit there and say, we cannot talk about sexuality to kids, like in Florida, you know, second grade, third grade, whatever, that is allowing so much sexual abuse to happen, which is ironic then, because then they turn and say, well, the LGBTQ+ community and teachers are groomers, but we're the ones who want to introduce these books that are children's picture books that say, and it's read in an age-appropriate developmental way, and to talk about if a adult has harmed you, who are trustworthy adults you can talk to, who are people within the community, professional, you know, psychiatrists, police officers, they can talk to about this happening. And when you blanket statement, no sexuality talk at all, you are allowing children to be abused. And it's ironic that the people passing that aren't seen as the groomers, but it's the people who want to introduce books and education on sexual assault to prevent it from happening to children. And again, these people aren't the what's the word I'm looking for? Not even professional, the experts in this, right? You have people who don't know education, passing education bills. Mm-hmm. There's children's books, picture books, board books that discuss tough topics in a way that children can understand in these metaphors and you know, that in make sense to them and reach them. And it's terrifying that that's not there.
Yeah, I think people get a little weirded out when they think that there are age-appropriate ways to talk about, to introduce certain kinds of concepts.
Right,
You know, you might not want to talk about the organic nature of sexual intercourse with a three-year-old, but certainly you can talk about their bodies. I mean, you can just certainly like name their bodies and right. just let people, or if they have a question about themselves, you can at least answer it honestly. I mean, there's just ways that you can allow children to be children and ask the questions they're going to ask and provide them an answer. I'm curious though, now that I'm thinking about that, you know, you do say, and I hear these policies a lot in regards to politicians and other, you know, activists, you know, around all sorts of areas, making statements like social and cultural issues shouldn't be discussed in the classroom by teachers, et cetera, et cetera. Can you think of a time when a social and cultural issue was okay to talk about that it became not okay to talk about? Or did one, you know, was one not okay and now it is okay? Because I feel like those are such diaphanous terms that you turn around and you're like, well, we were teaching this in class 3 years ago as standard practice, and now suddenly it's, how dare you teach that?
Yeah. The only thing I can think of is something that will probably piss, you know, even, I will say that we're conservatives off, is how we teach Thanksgiving, for example. That's changed. I don't teach Thanksgiving that way. I refused to let my students do the, you know, after a while, right? If you know better, you do better. And I am a product of a conservative Indiana education. And so for years, I did not know better. So I did not do better. And I upheld a lot of very violent and racist ideas because that's what I was taught. And then realized and taking a step back and saying, like, this didn't happen, right? Thanksgiving did not happen. In fact, like, there was really no celebration like this. And so to sit there and allow children to dress up in this like fabricated thing, it seemed harmful. And so I stopped doing that. And that was something I taught maybe the first 2 or 3 years I was teaching, and then stopped. But I can't think of the flip side of that. I know that when I, you know, again, we live in the Philly suburbs. Some of my students lived in more towards, you know, the city. And when we had the, I don't even say, I'm trying to figure out the word I want to use, but the demonstrations, you know, last summer, when George Floyd was murdered, that was something that, if not given a child context of what's going on, that can be scary, right? Mm-hmm. In our, you know, small suburb town, people were, you know, out there with signs. There were probably like, I don't know, hundreds or thousands of them outside, and a child just driving across that, that could be scary for them. And so that is a thing that we talked about in my class. There was a book, I think it was called Something Happened on Our Street, or Something Happened in Our Town. Yeah. And then one that I don't like as much, but again, it was one that was for a while was good. And you can kind of talk your way through some of the problem stuff is Smoky Nights as well. And so I was reading that, and it is a way of describing to kids, hey, something did happen. And this is why people might be angry. And it's okay to be angry sometimes, because if it was my student, or if I had a child and it was my child, I probably would set a town on fire too. You know what I mean? Until someone would listen to me. And so that's a thing where people, now, did I go into detail about everything that happened? Absolutely not, right?
Oh, because no, you pulled out your charts, your graphs, said, there were laser pointers.
Watch the video of this happening. I didn't do that. And it would be inappropriate. But when we don't give them a full idea of the context, right? A parent told their child, the parent was a nurse, and said the kid was asking about COVID because mom was really worried about going to work and getting COVID. And she said, it's just like, it's people get like a cold, you know, people get sick. And it wasn't that, but it was the easiest way to explain it to the child, they thought. And then we only shut down for like 8 weeks and came right back before there were masks, before there was anything. We come back to work, and about a month.
But you're heroes.
But we're heroes. didn't get paid for it, but we're heroes. And we risked our, just another time that teachers were asked to risk their lives in the classroom. But the student comes in, he's crying hysterically. And I was like, what is going on? He was like, my grandma is sick and is hysterical and she's got, you know, and his grandma gets just a, is it a cold? And yeah. I called mom and mom said, oh my God, we told him that COVID was like a cold. He probably thinks that's what it is. Well, that's why we have to give them a little bit more and give them a little bit of understanding, because when you flub up like that and the child sits there and thinks anyone with a cold can die at any minute, and mom's not walking into the house and putting her clothes in the laundry boot and then running upstairs to take a shower before seeing her family, and they have that kind of anxiety, and you don't think they do, but they hear the TV you're watching in the background, they hear your conversations that you have at the table when you think they're napping, and then they get a sneeze and your child thinks, God, I have the cold. We need to give them a little bit more details. And you know, when the demonstrations happened in Philadelphia, I think it is incredibly important. This might be a thing that people are missing. I think this is a step that a lot of radical teachers miss too, because we need to partner with the families that we work with. And mm-hmm. a lot of these issues that we're having, not all of them by any stretch of the imagination, but a lot of these issues I think we're having in the classroom is teachers and parents alike being so bullheaded, not wanting to work together, because there was seldom a time that I brought up I don't know of a time I gave a lesson plan where a parent was upset about what I taught, because I always have that conversation with the families beforehand, right? Like if you invite them in to it, now that doesn't mean I'm very lucky I had no objections. I don't know what I would have done if I had. We're gonna talk about it anyways, pull them out that day, I don't know. But when we at least invite the person to the conversation and validate what could be a fear of theirs and talk to them about why it shouldn't be a fear, or at least that, again, we just don't feel validated. I feel like that takes a lot of the anxiety and the pitchforks away.
That actually dovetails nicely with my next question. I want to know, just in your opinion, professional opinion, personal opinion, who do you think should be in charge of designing what education looks like in the classrooms? Because we do hear a lot of parents need to be in control. But you know what? I don't feel like telling a plumber how he needs to plumb. I don't know. Is that even the right word? Plumbers don't need to hear from me about plumbing.
Right. There are so many professions we have where we do not even think to correct. I used to use the word doctor. I used to talk about doctors all the time, and LOL now. but even then, people are willing to, it's just, they'll find the doctor that agrees with them, you know, there are so many professions we have out there where people aren't going to sit there and tell them how to do it or how to, and it's wild that teaching is one of those things where, no, let's definitely have the parents' input on this. Because we cannot put one family's values in it for everyone. If we all have the same values and religion and culture and outlook, fine. That's not the case. So for you to sit there and say, ooh, don't talk about Black History Month, when your child is the only fucking white kid in the classroom, that's not a thing, you know, that like we can't do that. And so and why would you want to? Like people deserve, and children deserve to be visible and represented and celebrated in their classrooms. And so it's not parents. I think parents are very welcome and should voice concerns if they have them, right? Because we can flip this around and say, I don't want my kid to be learning about religion in the classroom either. And parents should be able to voice those concerns and say, I don't want them to learn about Christianity, or that these medical ideas have to be this way because of this, you know. It needs to be educators. If we're allowing them to go to school and we're saying you have to have a degree to do this, if we're saying you have to have higher, you know, get a master's then to do this, credentials, hours each year that you have to do, then why aren't these the people you're turning to when you're writing curriculum and state standards? Why are policy holders and legislators when doing that when they have no idea what education is? I mean, Betsy DeVos has a great example of that. Like it can't just be anyway. It has to be someone who knows kind of what's going on. I think every state should have a team of either retired educators or people who were, you have to be in the classroom. I can't stand people who get an education degree and then like go write curriculum. It's like, what? people who've been in the classroom across, you know, pre-K through, you know, seniors in high school and everything in between, and sit down and write what makes sense and what they're seeing. Because I would respect that and disagree with them because they're educators and now, rather than parents and politicians saying what we can do in our classrooms.
Let's talk about, let's spend some more time inside of the classroom for a moment, because there are two things that are starting to become daily conversations in the news media, on social media, just kind of everywhere. For some reason, queer kids existing right. in classrooms, specifically right. trans kids right. existing in classrooms. I see your shirt is actually very visibly in support of trans students. How has that conversation evolved inside of classrooms? I feel like people looking at these stories from the outside might have one perspective on how that conversation right. is evolving inside of schools, but how is it actually evolving? And you know, what are teachers doing?
There's this idea of like indoctrinating kids, and we're not doing that because that would be exhausting. Like I don't want to change who a child is, right? That's not why what I'd ever want to do. I don't want everyone to be a cookie cutter rendition of the next person. That's a boring world. And so I think there's an idea of what's happening in classrooms. And I think too, and I will say, because I do think there are people out there who take it too far, right? And we know that. I sometimes am scrolling through TikTok and, you know, a conspiracy theorist will, you know, mash me with another video of another video, another video. And I see some of these teachers. I'm like, why do you think that is appropriate to do in the classroom? Like, it's just like, and so I think there's a fear of what's happening in everyday, I will say public schools, right? Mm-hmm. Schools and in my classroom, for example, everything was just gender neutral. There wasn't, we had private bathrooms, we had two private bathrooms in our classroom. And so I was about privacy. Kids need privacy. So they, because it was, you know, one bathroom and one bathroom, there was no boy or girl bathroom because each kid went in them by themselves. It does not have to be, if there's, you know, no one in the other bathroom, it doesn't make sense that, you know, a boy can't go in there because it's a girl's bathroom. No, there's no other kid in there. Go. I don't care. It's a bathroom. And same with, you know, we would never say boys line up, girls line up. It was like, if you were in blue line up, if you're in green line up, because we so quickly gender everything, right? And do, even if you don't do that, do we have some natural pull? Sure, I guess. I don't know. I thought that for years and would sit there and be like, no, it's not just the little girls that want to do arts and crafts. Is it a lot of time? Yeah, they're 100% of three or four boys that I'd rather do that than go play in the dirt. You know, everything is so fluid. And so I'm not gonna sit there and fight these gender norms in my classroom and sit there and tell a kid what they can and can't do, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's how it looks in my classroom. The kids, if a boy wants to wear high heels and hold the baby, that's fine. He's 9 out of 10 times doing it because he saw mom do it and not because he's trans, because we mimic our parents. If you give mm-hmm. a child a phone in the classroom, you don't want to sit around because they're going to repeat a conversation they heard you do. Like, that is something, if you give one of my students a classroom, verbatim.
I don't know of any boy of any sexuality that right. doesn't have at least that one photo where he's wearing his mom's heels when he's like 3 years old.
100%. And it's, it has nothing to do with sexuality. And I have had that conversation with a dad one time. When I first mm-hmm. started teaching, he walked in and the son was holding a baby doll. And he set up a meeting with me that week and was like, I was really upset when I saw that. And I was like, why? And he was like, I don't have to be, and he stopped himself. I'm like, gay? Like, because I think he felt uncomfortable. And I said, we know toys don't make children gay, right? And he like didn't know what to say to that. And I said, I'm assuming you held him as a child. And he said, yes. I said, so if you wanted your son someday to have a baby, don't you want him to know how to hold it? Like, why is holding a baby inherently gay? I've never gone across the street and been like, that guy's holding a baby, gay. But a toy version of that is. And it's, it, it, it was weird that I never thought that way. I mean, like, mm-hmm. I'm sure, like, growing up, my parents were like, you should probably grab the Batman action figure rather than the Barbie doll. And it's such a silly thing, right? Like, if we're looking at it from a very heteronormative thing, don't you want Batman to be married or to have a girlfriend? Why can't they boy grab a Barbie then? And I see it, and I get flack for saying this, but I see it a lot more with boys than I ever see with girls. Because when a girl plays in the dirt, or she plays with a truck, or doesn't want to wear her dress, and the parents are like, she's a tomboy,
right.
Feminism. But if a boy does that, a little boy wore they couldn't find a Frozen shirt with Elsa Anna in it that was in the boy section. And so he was wearing a little girl's t-shirt, and the only way you could tell that it might not be a boy's t-shirt, I hope people know I'm doing the finger thing, was that there was like little frills at the end, and the mom's like, I'm worried kids are gonna make fun of him, but we can't find an Anna and Elsa t-shirt, but I can go to Walmart and find truck t-shirts for little girls. There needs to, one, not be gendered clothes, because it's fabric, but it's just this wild thing of I don't know, the classroom is, I don't think people realize how easy it is to be gender neutral, and it doesn't have to be a radical thing, it doesn't have to be an uncomfortable thing, and most people do it anyways. When we're in our classrooms, I think that most parents would appreciate it. It's just now a buzzword. It's most of the time it's always been that way for years.
I do want to ask about a really tough topic when it comes to small children and schools, but one that is unfortunately becoming more a part of our rhetoric, school shootings.
Yeah.
I think that people, even our age, you hear those words and you think high school and you think junior, senior. I mean, like, you think young adults, you think 17, 18 year olds for some reason. I think everybody thinks of every school shooting as Columbine.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of school shootings involving kids your age that you teach. Do you all have those terrifying drills in class? Yeah. What is that like? What questions are kids asking? What does this look like from inside that classroom?
Yeah. This is such a hard topic. So it's so hard, right? I remember being young and Columbine happening, and just never thought it could happen. Mm-mm. To anyone younger, right? And I remember I was in my classroom, and it might have been I don't remember what year I was teaching. I was in my classroom, and I was at my desk, and we were getting ready to do the next activity, and my teaching partner's phone kept going off for news alerts. And she said, I think we need to turn on the news or something. I was like, okay, well, we're not gonna, so put on my computer, and it's Sandy Hook. And the principal came over the loudspeaker and said, I need everyone to check their emails. And again, I lived in Indiana. I didn't live around where, you know, in the town Sandy Hook happened. It was just such a startling thing that happened. And we knew when stuff like that happens, kind of like 9/11, everyone picked up their children, right? So kids were getting picked up. Because you never know what's going to happen, right? You don't know. Like, there were so many unanswered questions, and we had never experienced this before, a mass shooting at an elementary school. And I remember putting a movie on for the kids to watch so that we could figure out what was happening, because I couldn't, my mind couldn't, I was so confused. And then I remember going on lunch break, it wasn't really lunch break, and sobbing in my car and turn on NPR and just like, it seemed like it kind of happened. And then having to have the real discussion the next day with students about what happens when, people come into the classroom and or the schools, and this is a very real thing. And unfortunately, after Columbine, we had shooting drills, you know, once a month when I was in school. And Mrs. Blue was the thing that they've retired now, because it was so, everyone knew what that was. And I my first year teaching, we had what I thought was a drill, and it wasn't. And I was using the staff bathroom, and a man across the street, there is a apartment complex, and he was highly intoxicated and was carrying around a rifle. He had no intention of hurting anyone. He was just super drunk, walking around his apartment complex with a rifle. we had to put us on lockdown. And I remember opening the bathroom door to go back to my classroom, and a literal SWAT team told me how to get back in there. And a police officer walking by and explained to me what happened. And I thought this was it. And I remember saying, can you walk me to my classroom? Because if someone's gonna get hurt, I don't want to be in the bathroom by myself. I want to be with my kids. And I remember them escorting me back to my classroom. That was my first year teaching. I was 22. Mm-hmm. So this stuff that continues to happen, I think this year was even hearing, what happened in Texas was even harder, because the autonomy is being stripped away from teachers, and from specifically BIPOC and queer teachers. And, having articles from alt-right conspiracy theorists just drag me through the dirt for being an advocate. And then the same time being like, take a bullet for your students and arm yourself with a gun, and police won't come in and help you. The good guys with guns won't help you. You just need to figure it out. So it's like, am I a hero, or am I this pervert who's like, what is it?
Right.
And you could not pay me enough to go back into the classroom right now. And rather I'm trying to step outside and advocate for the people who are still there, because I could not do it anymore in the classroom. And something just clicked when the school shooting in Texas happened. I was like, what the fuck is happening? And again, for the last couple of months, Indiana and all these states passing these bills, and all of a sudden, like, teachers are heroes. That's not what you're trying to pass, though, in your legislation. So which is it? It's unfathomable. It's hard to look at a 3, 4, 5-year-old and tell them, this is very serious. You need to stay quiet while we are locked in our classroom bathroom. You need to stay quiet. But you can't scare them enough that they'll start crying, mm-hmm. but you need to let them know this is serious enough that you can't giggle or laugh or talk, or we'll all die. So
I hate to laugh, but that's just so grim. I don't know about another reaction.
it was uncomfortable. I remember we had a drill, and my students were so loud, and so I missed them saying it was a drill. The only other thing I heard was, however many minutes later, them saying we're under a whatever lockdown. And so I walked the door, locked it. We had this, again, two bathrooms. So I took half of the class in with our assistant, and the other teacher took the other half of the class in the other one. And the assistant was like 19. I mean, she was in school for, education. And I turned my phone upside down, and I started doing, turned the flashlight on, and I put a jacket under the door so they couldn't see the light leak. And I was just making animal puppets on the ceiling. I looked over, and the assistant's crying. And I remember looking at her and saying, you don't get to do that. And I remember telling her, like, you can't, that's not a privilege we have. And I remember doing the puppets with the kids and kept telling them to calm down. And then hearing the principal come over and say, okay, everyone, you did the drill. But like, I didn't know it was a drill. So when I heard the classroom door shake, cause they're checking to see if you locked it, I'm like, it was,
oh my goodness.
I don't think people aren't going to get it. And then when I've told the story at professional developments or in a conference that I speak at, and I hear teachers say, that's why I have suckers in my lollipops. And this is very Midwest, called a sucker, lollipops or lifesavers in my desk drawer, because I give it to the kids so that they can eat something so they won't talk. And I was, a teacher told me that, and I just was hysterical. Even now I'm like fighting. Because that's our reality. So then when we're told we can't have a pride flag or talk about, celebrating Black and Brown excellence, but we have to tell kids that they could be murdered in the classroom, that's a disconnect I'm not okay with.
How do we support educators? Because the only thing that I know of about how outside folks can help educators is Amazon wish lists that right. go viral on Twitter after Neil Gaiman retweets them. And that feels bleak. So what right. can we do?
And it's hard too, because it's like, in a perfect world, and I don't want to discourage this, but like, voting is the number one thing you can do to mm-hmm. look at who you're voting for, to not always, myself included, as a, someone who is a Democrat, be okay with not voting straight ticket if that one candidate does not align with an issue. Fine. I am so sick of people saying, I'm fiscally Republican, but look, socially liberal, then vote that way. Do you vote that way? I don't think you vote that way. I think you vote straight ticket down. Because in like I said, it's not just a Democrat or Republican issue, right? Look at the people you're voting for. Are they supporting teachers and education and safe schools? Because if they're not, you can keep the mug you give me every Christmas, and you can keep the crazy art crayons you give me, because it's kind of like the you know, corporations that are, you know, LGBT allies for June, and then go about their rest of their year after that. It's a slap in the face to vote for people passing this legislation, and then to turn around and be like, what Eric Carle book can I get you for, you know, your first day of school? It's just, yeah, it's voting. It's giving the space for educators to speak and pass the mic to them. Mental health for educators is incredibly important. Again, this is, I think teaching is one of the only professions we ask for the worker to take a bullet for other people without training them, without giving them any, and I'm not advocating for guns for teachers by any stretch of imagination, but it's grim. it's very grim.
Okay, so you're an influencer now. You're just a full-on, you know, you and Elise Myers have Starbucks every couple of days, I imagine. So you now have this platform. Obviously, like you said at the beginning, you didn't seek this platform intentionally. You made a couple of joke videos, and now you have a platform, because that's just how the algorithm works, right?
Right, yeah.
What pressure do you feel to use that platform in any particular way? And do you feel like there needs to be maybe an understanding by casual viewers that, you know, not everybody that saw it, you did actually just put out a video today or yesterday or something like that, about the fact that so many folks who have large numbers of followers, we do other things, you know, and we didn't seek fame for fame's sake.
No.
So now that we have this platform, there's all of this responsibility that comes with having some kind of platform. How do you meet that responsibility? Do you think that the idea of having responsibility by dint of having a follower count is unfair? Let's talk about that.
I think it depends, right? I think that really, honestly and truly depends. It sucks that it's by issue, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not expecting someone who is solely on TikTok as a makeup influencer to necessarily talk about not any issue, right? But some issues. I'm trying to think of an example of one, and I just can't. Like, I wish I could. Maybe a makeup influencer wasn't the right example, but like, I had a huge issue and called in to conversation and call people out, and it was just so frustrating to see a lot of, I'm going to use the TikTok teachers and sure. the Instagram yeah. teachers, influencers, when the Don't Say Gay bill got passed in Florida, right? And we have all of these TikTokers who talked about, you know, positivity and all this stuff, wouldn't say a word about the bill being passed. And mm-hmm. I had a problem with that. And this is why, because we have benefited off of our students' stories, and we've benefited off of other teachers watching us, parents watching us. We've made money off of that. And when something has happened to this group, to a school, right, whether you are for or against LGBTQ plus rights, people are passing legislation in states that should be passed, and that's when you're going to go silent. You have an obligation to speak up, because you have benefited and you've financially made gain on telling your student stories, and you're not going to defend some of those same students now. That's gross to me. On the flip side of that, though, there's probably multiple things that, like, as we don't have to comment on every single issue, if one more person asked me to comment or make a video on the Amber Heard and Johnny Depp case, I was going to drill a hole in my fucking head, because I do not give a shit. Like, they were both very, very toxic people, and there was a lot of fucked up shit that happened with that trial. I'm not the person to do that, because I know nothing about the legal system or anything.
You are now, neither in that relationship. You're not a lawyer. You're not.
Not at all. Not at all. If you are a influencer that's a victim's advocate, you probably have a obligation to speak out about that. I don't. I have no idea what that is. So I think it depends. I also think there's things that, because you have a large following or a blue check mark or both, people will run to you and be like, you need to comment on this issue. I don't know anything about this issue. Yeah. I can, like, I'm, and I think it'd be, it wouldn't be good for me to do that. It would be a very uneducated choice, and something
it's it's a Kendall Jenner Pepsi commercial. It's you know,
right.
It's an empty gesture. I've done a podcast. I've been a person for a long time now, over 10 years. And I just feel like every time something comes up, there are always those folks that like trip over themselves to be the first to give a take.
Yeah.
And the more that happens and the faster the take is, the more performative it feels.
Yes.
And I feel like if so many people trip over themselves to be the first to give a take, you're not making space for the voices that should be heard at that time anyways.
Right. And this is the thing that I think bothers me so much, right? So there's not a lot of social justice issues that I have not spoke up about, because that's something that I think affects the educators and the students that I am advocating for. There's also space where it's not for you to talk about. Mm-hmm. And that is when there is a beautiful thing called a repost or a fucking stitch. And you can do that or duet it and not put your face in it. But you can sit there and upload that video if you have the a mass following that, you know, that's important to say, but it's not for you to talk about, right? Mm-hmm. But for you to sit there and say, my followers need to hear this, and they might not be on the algorithm that's going to put this out to them. And I think that is something that we also have to recognize too. When you are solely not speaking up because you are worried that, although you might think that Roe versus Wade being overturned is terrifying and horrible, and you believe in body autonomy, or you believe in, you know, queer and LGBTQ plus rights, but you don't want to speak up about it because you're afraid to lose your followers or to make a splash, that is when I completely lose respect. When it's not because you don't know enough about it, it's because you're worried about the money and you're worried about the following loss. Mm-hmm. If I woke up tomorrow and my accounts were at zero followers, I would be going to class at 5:30 like I do every day. It does not matter to me. What is the point of having this platform if I am so scared to lose the followers that I don't do what is right? And yeah, it's a double-edged sword right there. I feel like we can't sit there and say every influencer has a responsibility to talk about these things, because some of them don't, right?
No.
Like if you're a meme account, what the fuck? With that said, most of the meme accounts spoke out quicker about Roe versus Wade and LGBTQ plus rights than any other account. So and you're right, if you're the first one, just to sit there. And there's a lot of, on the flip side, there's a lot of advocacy accounts who want to just be the first and who steamroll and bulldoze conversations. And it's like, you know, we see, you know, white people all the time being the first to talk about a, you know, black or brown issue. And it's like, this isn't for you. And to not be okay when you mess up, to listen to the people of the community you're advocating for tell you you're wrong. And it, you know, it's just, it's, there's a lot of performative stuff. And it's definitely made me realize I do not want to permanently for the rest of my life be on social media as an influencer.
I was talking to an author yesterday, Ayanna Gray, and I was saying, you know, I cannot wait, because the most recent video of mine to go viral is just about how authors, I'm an author, I've written some books, I'm writing another book, I was like, you know, it's just the pressure of authors to be a one person marketing team, and anybody that puts out content for monetary consumption, if you're an author or an artist or a musician, something like that, your publisher, your record label, your whatever is basically needing you to go viral in order to support you right now. And I was just, she and I were commiserating because I was like, I just want to get to a level that if I want to go on TikTok and make a stupid funny video, I'm doing it because I just want to have some fun. And I don't want to feel like a one person marketing team all the time. So I very much commiserate with you on wanting to get the hell off social media.
Yeah.
Or at least not have it feel like a job, like an extension of a job.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Oh, I think that's the thing. When you're doing something fun that becomes a job, then it's not fun anymore.
It's not fun. Parts of it are fun. Parts of it are fun. Right, it's cool to have people know who you are, and that's fun.
Right. I think there is also, when I made the video the other day, I was talking about, you know, comments that we make on these, you know, influencers accounts. And someone messaged me, they said, I said, we're not all the D'Amelios or Addison Rae. They said, well, we shouldn't be bullying them either. I'm like, I'm not. And so I was like, maybe that was a misstep. I'm not saying we should bully them. I'm saying most of us don't have those resources. And I recognize too, I am of a privilege where I do have a lot of those resources. But like, I also don't have the celebrity that they do where they can, you know, no one trained us on how to be an influencer. Yeah. And so I found myself, specifically when I got back from the comedy tour, and then recognized when people were stopping me, and I don't know what happened between the comedy tour and getting home, but it's like, it was every time I left the house that I realized like I never wanted this, and no, there's not a playbook on this. And I remember going to not talk about, because I was like, it's either really gross people tell, it's you're just on TikTok and Instagram, chill. You're not, you know, Selena Gomez.
Right, right.
But then not talking about it at all and seeing that when people come up, it doesn't affect me, I was completely invalidating and gaslighting myself. I finally got to, I started seeing therapy because of this anxiety of meeting people and people telling me very intimate details about their lives, you know, that their child had died of suicide because they weren't accepted at school. But if they had you as a teacher, that, you know, and those are beautiful things.
Oh, that's such a pressure.
It is such a pressure. It's a weight, or, you know, these queer men that are coming up to me and saying, you know, please don't stop what you're doing, stay on, never leave. And I'm like, that is so much put on one person. And I was just like, I can't do that. I had to go to a therapist. And I was like, well, I remember walking in, I'm just like, the 3-hour intake that you do, I was just sobbing. I'm like, this is hard. And I remember in the middle, like, I feel so gross for complaining or telling you about this. Like, I'm like, and it's, influencing is not necessary. And I think it's hard our age, because the youngest generation right now wants to be influencers. The older generation has no idea what influencing is. So they think that every influencer is a celebrity. My dad probably thinks that I like go to red carpets every day. And then the younger kids want the influencing. So we're in this weird middle group of like, knowing that it's a big thing, but then also having perspective on it.
Well, and I think having gone behind the curtain of a couple of things, obviously I don't have the follower count that you do, but I, you know, I'm behind the curtain of publishing with a big five. You know, I was published with Simon & Schuster last year, and I've, you know, to a person with 100 followers, 1,000 followers feels like a lot. And to a person with 1,000 followers, 10,000 followers feels like a lot, right, and so on, you know, you get to 100, so on. And it just, what I realized is that the people that you see on those New York Times bestseller lists probably still have a day job. Because publishing, there's just not money in it. There's, you know, there are so few people that are full-time authors, and most of those people have help. They have a partner or family that supports them in some kind of way, even if they're just giving them health insurance. That's something that I'm concerned about, because I give my husband health insurance. And I'm like, well, if I quit my day job to become a full-time author, who's going to give us health insurance? I'm going to need to hope for some polyamory to come around and go marry somebody else. I can get some health insurance. But I think that people have this weird idea about what it means to have a follower count and just sort of the other side of that. I do want to ask then about a couple of things. One, I want to ask about your nails. Your nails. One, you do have a nail polish. Is it your company, or are you partnered with a company? It's your company.
It's me. So my friend James came up with the idea and started it and asked me as he was starting if I would be his partner in it. So we're partners in it. He does all of the business stuff and I do the not business stuff, you know, mm-hmm. the content, the more of the creative side. But yeah, so, and we took a pretty long, I think we've paused it from like April and we're just now getting ready to start up again. So yeah, it's fun.
What's it called? What's the brand called?
It's called Boy Toy, BOITOI.
I feel like that was my AOL Instant Messenger screen name in like 2005.
Right. Like... Boy Toy 2020.
Oh man. Yes. That's yep. That sounds right. I love that I at the end of boy that just gives me the, just the sense B-O-I. Memories of yeah. that coming back.
A skater boy, right? Avril Lavigne's yeah. skater boy had an I in it. Yeah.
Yep. Yep, makes me want to wear a tank top with a necktie. So what is the importance of you wearing the nail polish? I mean, I know that you didn't have the company while obviously you were a teacher, but you did wear yeah. nail polish in front of students.
Yeah, so I remember as a kid, my sister had a caboodle
uh-huh.
and it was filled with like-
Loved a caboodle, love oh a God. Caboodle. When I was in theater growing up, I think my favorite part of being in theater was the caboodle with all my stage makeup in it. Oh love God. It. Love a caboodle.
It was like a gay fishing tackle box.
Oh my God. I love that. The straight theater guys did bring a tackle box.
Oh,
because,
yeah. Oh,
because, 100%. Yeah, you can't have a caboodle.
No, that'd be embarrassing, right?
Oh, God.
She had a pink caboodle and it had like the glitter inside of it.
I know exactly which one you're talking about.
My oldest sister is 10 years older than I am. And uh-huh. so she would be at a friend's house or whatever. And me and my younger sister would sneak in her room and we would drag the caboodle from out of her under her bed and we'd play with the bottles and pretend they were like people or whatever. Because I was not allowed to wear nail polish. And so if I wasn't allowed to wear it, I was going to play with it in these mm-hmm. bottles. And all my life, I've always wanted to wear nail polish. I just never was able to. And I remember for a while, especially in Indiana, I would do like clear coat and then I would get really embarrassed if someone noticed it was clear coat. And so fast forward, I'm teaching in Pennsylvania at this private school and a little boy comes in and he has navy and aqua nails, interchangeably on his fingers. And one of the directors said, Bobby, we'll call him Bobby. Bobby has his nails painted. I said, okay, because I'm walking. There was like a before school care. So like he had gotten there before I did. And I'm like, okay, his nails are painted, tell. And I was like, what? Okay. And it was like waiting for me to like make the first joke or something. And I was like, oh, I hate that. So I walked in and I made a big to-do about Bobby's nails. I'm like, Bobby, oh my gosh, come here. Let me see them. And I was like, you know what? I'm gonna paint my nails tomorrow because I wanted to let the classroom know right then and there, like, I thought it was cool and that we're not going to make fun of someone for painting their nails. Mm-hmm. And so I went to the store and I realized that I did not feel like I was allowed to be there getting nail polish and that I was nervous anytime someone walked by and I was going to grab it. And I was like, I'm just going to go. I'm not doing this. And I was like, nope, grab it. So I grabbed it to the navy and the light blue. And I went to the self-checkout because I didn't want to do it there. And I remember putting it in there and making a comment to the person next to me, or maybe it was even someone that worked there. I'm like, oh, it's not for me or whatever. And put it in there and left. And I painted one hand the next day because I could definitely not, you know, do the other. It was my first time painting my nails. And I was driving to work. And need to stop and get gas. And I go to walk in to pay for it and realize my nails are painted. And I shoved my hand in my pocket. I didn't want anyone to see it. And I realized my student was way braver than I ever was. And so I, from that day on, I painted my hand every single day. Wow. And have always had it. I think there was one day I was traveling to Florida and took it off and couldn't paint it before I had to get on the plane. And that's when I ran into someone that's like, are you Mr. Wormspire? Are your nails painted? And I'm like, I'm so sorry. The nail polish is in my bag. So I didn't, so I started painting and I would talk about it on TikTok and why I painted my nails. And I only painted one hand. I mean, now both of them are done, but I would only paint one hand because I felt like it in a very unintimidating way, invited people in to ask me why my nails were painted, who, if I had both, would kind of maybe just do this, but it brought people to be able to say, oh, why do you have one done? And kind of kindly bring them in. And because of that, this guy that I went to high school with, he was much older than I was, not much. I was a freshman, he was a senior, very successful in what he does. And he lives out in LA, said, I want to start a company for anyone who wants to wear nail polish. And we're going to name it Boy Toy because it is kind of like, the flipping that gender norm. And I want to donate 10% of all the proceeds to an LGBTQ plus organization. How do you feel about that? And I was like, absolutely. So I was at work for a little bit, for a few months, I think, before, while having Boy Toy. And then, I ended up leaving. Yeah.
A couple of other things I just wanted to ask about some of your videos that you've made. What is the worst or weirdest thing you've ever gotten in those teacher appreciation gift bags, or maybe that a parent's given you? What's just like, oh, thanks.
I'm trying to think. It's usually the parents are pretty good. Uh-huh. It's the kids who just bring something from home that they think that we would, that they have not told their parents. The amount of jewelry I've gotten during Teacher Appreciation Week, I'm like, yo, you can't do that. I think one of the funniest things I got, which was odd.
But then you realized how big the diamond was, and you were like, maybe you can do that. Maybe I don't know where that ring went. I don't know. It's a great tennis bracelet.
Yeah, never brought it to me. so a parent got me a bottle of wine, and then I don't know how they did it, but they put a sticker of their child on, and it was like the reason you drink, and gave that to me. And I thought that was so funny and humorous to like invite the parent into the conversation. Like, their kiddo was very challenging, but I loved, and it was so nice to have a parent that was like receptive and understood that. So I don't think I've had, now on the flip side, gifts I've gotten from the school during teacher appreciation has been like a fanny pack that broke the second I put it on. And like, I can't even think of like all the random, a pencil with your name on it. I'm like, keep it.
Thank you.
Like it's the weird thing was, and I've said this because so many people think of it as like a materialistic thing. Like, if my director or principal or whoever just wrote me a long personalized card about the good I was doing, that would have always been enough. And when parents, sure, a lot of my times at Head Start, parents did like, they had no money, and so a parent could brought me in a snack size of Chips Ahoy, and I would have cried, sure, because it's, sure, just that you were thought of. It was just we're a private school who make a fuck ton of money. Here is a fanny pack that's about to break, and you're like, yeah, thanks. Keep it. Write me a card instead.
Are there that many hot dads?
Yes. Yes, there are so many hot dads. It's wild. And it's always one that you didn't see at the beginning of the year. It's always one that they were busy at back to school night, and they sneak up, and she like 2 months in, at the pickup line, and you're like, hold the phone. That's not okay. You don't like, the right. My favorite is when they would come in, if I had to do like after school duty, uh-huh, some of the parents would, I go to the work and then I go to the gym. And so some of the dads would come in these tank tops stuff. I'm like, you know what you're doing, sir.
You knew exactly what you said.
Yeah. So many hot dads. It's insane. It's stupid, really.
Just finally, is there anything that's giving you hope about education?
Yeah, I think I was really fortunate to be in this weird position where I went back to school for social work and did a 4-year BSW program in 2 years. And I was with kids anyway between 18 and 22 years old. And I had these preconceived notions about that generation. And being in social justice classes with them, and seeing this next generation of people coming up, definitely gives me hope. And it gives me hope that they can teach the parents that are fueling so much hate a moment of clarity. But the generation that we have coming up and the teachers that are in the classrooms now, every day I hear stories from them, that gives me tons of hope.
Well, Tel Williams, thank you so much for being here today and for answering all of my little questions. If folks want to get a little bit more of you, where can they find you online?
On, I think on TikTok, YouTube, and Instagram, it's all at Mr. Williams Pre-K. Oh, and literally any of the Facebook, TikTok, Instagram stuff, it's all at Mr. Williams Pre-K, I think.
How did I not ask you about pre-K pause? How many people a day say come up to you and say pre-K pause?
Well, I think they're confused by my name. So like my agent will get emails from, you know, companies that want to work with me. And they'll be, can William Spreck? And I'm like, it's all the time. William Spreck, every time. I had a thing of Per Ibrin and it said William Spreck on it. I don't think they realize it's Mr. Williams, pre-K. And when people find it out, they laugh. So when they see me in public, they don't know to say Mr. Williams. So they say, are you pre-K pause? Or they'll just scream pre-K pause and I'll turn around. They will. I don't know that I've ever had someone say, you know, right away, are you Mr. Williams? They're like, pre-K pause, are you Mr. Williams? And then they drop it off at the end because they don't know if there's an M or an S. It's really funny. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Tell Williams, for being here. I appreciate it. Good luck to you, sir.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, folks, that's going to do it here for us today on this episode of Head on Fire. I know it's a couple of days past when you were expecting it to be, but hey, all of my guests have real life jobs and some stuff had to get moved around given recent events. But I am so glad that my guest, Tell Williams, was able to be here to round out Pride Month with me. Make sure to go watch his new show, The Book of Queer, on Discovery Plus, and go support him on all socials. He's a great guy. If you like this show and you want to support it, there are a number of ways to help. Consider sharing it with your friends on social media. You could also like or rate the show 5 stars on places like Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And while you're there, leave a review. Reviews help recommend the show to other listeners like you. You can also help keep the show free and producing regularly by joining my Patreon on a monthly basis. Patrons receive additional audio and video content, as well as archived episodes, a private Discord server, and a monthly book club. We're currently reading Bad Gays. Sign up at patreon.com/headonfirepod. If you would like to connect with me on social media, I am pretty much at headonfirepod everywhere. Instagram, Twitter, TikTok. Thank you all so much for downloading the show. Please be safe out there. And remember, Pride wasn't always floats. It began with bricks. Stay safe, everybody.